This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bonnie Raitt's 1989 album Nick of Time revived her career. It also gave a boost to the career of John Hiatt, who wrote the album's hit Thing Called Love. Hiatt's songs have also been recorded by Bob Dylan, the Neville Brothers, Roseanne Cash, and the Everly Brothers, but Hiatt hasn't yet had a hit of his own. In 1985, Hiatt gave up long-term addictions to alcohol and drugs. His next two albums, Bring the Family and Slow Turning, received widespread critical acclaim and were described in Rolling Stone magazine as two of the finest albums of the 80s. John Hiatt has a new album called Stolen Moments. This is the title song.
I used to drink a lot in those days, you see. Yeah, that's the way the wind blows. These days the only bar I ever see has got lettuce and tomatoes. I get pumped up in the back of my
Hiatt, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's nice to be here, Terry.
I think one of the things people really like about your lyrics is that they're written from the perspective of someone who's been around a while. I mean, you write about adult love. Do you know what I mean? And you write about complex emotions. You write stories in your lyrics. Were you always confident that stuff like that could be fit into a lyric and expressed in a song?
You know, I think basically I've just been bluffing because I don't know the first thing about adult love. I do try and act like I know something about it, but golly, I'm talk about your arrested development, emotionally speaking, Terry. You got the original right here. I've sort of always written about love, I guess.
When you were a young man, you went to...
I'm still a young man,
Terry. That didn't come out right, did it? when you were very young, you were in your early 20s or something, or even a teenager, I'm not sure which, you went to Nashville, and you became a house writer for a music publishing company.
Yes.
And I'd love to hear what life was like inside a publishing company where you really had to churn it out every day.
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't actually do that. There wasn't a lot of people are under the impression that there's like quota writing and that sort mm-hmm. of thing, which may have been the case in some houses, but it wasn't at Tree, which is where I wrote. But what you had there was you had a lot of great craftsmen. I'm thinking of writers when I was there. You had writers like Curly Putnam, who wrote The Green, Green Grass of Home, and a fellow named Bobby Braddock was somebody I looked up to, wrote... hits for George Jones and Tammy Wynette and people like that. And I was very young and very, I was very intent on not writing, you know, anything that even resembled a country song. I was, you know, the rebel from the North, if that's possible. And, you know, I really didn't know how good I had it there until after the fact. I look back on those times today, and I really feel like through osmosis, because I really was too much of a knucklehead to pick it up at the time. But I feel like just being around those guys, I learned a lot just about the craft of songwriting.
What were your very early songs like when you first went to Nashville?
Pretty bad. Pretty gosh darn bad. Salesman dying, hanging by the necktie. And pretty real overly dramatic kind of stuff. And it hasn't gotten a whole lot better.
How would performers get matched up with your songs? Did they come directly to you? Did they go to the publishing house?
In those days?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I had two songs covered, I think, in 5 years. So my biggest hit, so to speak, during those Tree years was a song that a group called Three Dog Night heard and covered. It was a song called Sure As I'm Sitting Here. And but see, I really wasn't writing the kind of tunes that you could take around the corner to Billy Sherrill and get George Jones to record, and that's kind of how it worked down there in those days. You could write a song on Wednesday and they'd play it for Billy on Thursday. George would cut it on Friday and it'd be out on Monday, or so it seemed.
A lot of people have recorded your songs over the years. Do you hear new qualities in one of your songs when someone else sings them?
All the time, yeah, absolutely. It's a real thrill, you know, to hear someone interpret you.
Let me play you singing the song that Bonnie Raitt recorded on her record that was a big hit, and this was a really important record in her career. And this is your song, Thing Called Love, that you recorded this on your 1987 album, Bring the Family. Let's play it, and then I want to ask you a couple of things about
okay,
it.
Okay, great.
It's John Hiatt singing his own song, Thing Called Love. When you hear yourself do it and hear Bonnie Raitt do the same song, what do you think of as being the differences in your interpretations of it?
Well, I'd say right off the bat, she was a little more, a lot more sort of sultry, sexy about it all, you know, as only she can be. I kind of was like a little more like a bull in a china closet, you know. Which is kind of my approach. And, I loved her version of it. Of course, she has such a wonderful voice, but then you couple that with that, her slide style is, you know, silky and really dirty at the same time, and I really think she did it great on that song.
So what was going on in your life that inspired the song?
Well, those very items, you know, putting it on the line in terms of... that thing called love. You know, I had met my wife and I was going after her with much fervor and commitment and dedication and trying wholeheartedly to convince her that I was worth the risk, even though on paper maybe I didn't add up to such a good shot. So it had very much to do with my life at the time.
In 1987, your record Bring the Family came out, and I think this was the first album that you made after giving up drugs and alcohol. How much do you think that the changes you made in your life accounted for the changes in your career?
Well, I think the effect it had was a pretty simple mathematical one. I spent so much time procuring and consuming, you know, alcohol and dope, and you know, spending great amounts of time and energy in that lifestyle that I really didn't have. You know, my work suffered basically. You just don't have a whole lot of time to sit down and write tunes when you're out there, you know, doing the lambada. So to speak.
You said that you lived in bars back in the days that you were a drinker. Did you go to neighborhood bars or more music industry type bars? You know, like entertainment biz bars?
No, I kind of shunned those places, except when I'd want to really work up a good resentment and drink at people. You know, I used to kind of dig that, drinking at people. Then I'd go to those bars because I'd need some grist for the mill, you know.
Yeah.
So, boy, I'd drink at them. Yeah, I'd drink at them, and of course, did a lot of good. You know, they didn't change, and so, and of course, why the hell should they? They were just fine. It turned out that old JH had to do some changing, you know. Ooh. And of course, that's something we don't like. It's a nasty job having to work on yourself. Don't you think, Terry?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Were you sociable when you got drunk?
Well, I think to a point. I think to a point, but then I would turn, see? This the evil twin Skippy would come out.
Right.
Yeah. And golly, he got into trouble.
You have a song on your new record called 30 Years of Tears.
Yeah.
Is the 30 years an allusion to the years that you... Well, I guess you're not old enough to...
Yes, I've been drinking since I was seven, Terry.
Right.
A wee lad of seven. Had my first dram. Irish whiskey it was. It's not that far off. I think I tipped my first half pint of Dark Eyes cherry vodka when I was about 12.
Uh-huh.
So...
So what are the 30 years that you're referring to?
Well, that tune kind of came out of... A rough spot in our marriage, where some pain that personal pain that I you know, you don't want to have to face this stuff, and I was faced with, you know, remnants stuff hanging around in me that I'd been lugging around with me, you know, suitcases full. Buckets of tears and things. And I was trying to pin them on events, current events, when in fact they were old. It was old stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's hear the record.
Okay.
This is John Hiatt from his new album, Stolen Moments. The song is 30 Years of Tears.
This is a place my poor head to gather my thoughts in sweet silence. And is this a place where the feelings aren't dead from an overexposure to violence? And is this a place I can slow and know? These are tears from a long time ago. I've got these tears from a long time ago, and I need to cry 30 years or so. These are tears from a long time ago. Oh darling, oh darling.
John Hiatt from his new album Stolen Moments. We were talking about the problems that you had till around 1985. What got you to stop? What got you to stop? You know, doing drugs and drinking.
Well, no nobleness on my part. It was really just it had whipped me soundly.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't have any choice. That pretty much sums it up.
Did you have to learn to perform without being high? Was it a different experience for
you?
Yeah,
it sure was. It was kind of tricky at first. Woo!
What did you have to do to get the feel for it?
Well, I had to tough it out. I went out on my first tour with about 6 months. I'd been sober about 6 months. And, well, I'll tell you what I did. I had my little conversation with the... you know, whatever or whoever runs the show, and I don't pretend to know what or who that is. And I said to this entity that I was willing to stop doing this if it meant that I couldn't do it and stay sober. And then ensued about 3 weeks of touring that, you know, I'd be up on stage, and in the middle of a song, I'd be talking to myself, in my head going, what are you doing up here? You're bluffing. This is, you're a fake, you're a phony. What is this? You're not in touch with your, what are you even singing about? You know, really wondering about the whole deal. And then after about, it seemed like 3-4 weeks into the tour, I started to get a sort of a sense of the music. And it was almost like, not to get corny about it, but what the hell? It felt like the gift of music was kind of slowly being given back to me somehow. It was a nice thing. And so I feel like in finally being willing to let go of it, I got it back.
What about the process of writing songs? Was that any harder or easier when you became sober?
I couldn't really write anything to speak of for about a year. And there again, I had to be willing to do that. I had to be willing to go through that. And I've since met writers who have had alcohol or drug problems and have gotten clean and sober and have had a similar problem.
You know, I haven't seen any pictures of you
when you were
very young. No. I've seen pictures recently, but I should say you're in the New York bureau and I'm in Philadelphia, so we are not looking at each other face to face now. But I've seen plenty of pictures of you, and you're a very lean guy now. But I've read about you that you're a very fat kid.
Yeah.
And it's just hard for me to imagine because you look nearly gaunt on your photographs now. I mean, did the dissolute lifestyle thin you out?
I've got this eating. I'm a eating disorder whacked out kind of guy too. See, and so I go from one. I went from being obese. You know, food was kind of used as dope at my house when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
It served to, you know, fill up the hole. You know, anything we could get to stuff down in there. But what I found for me is I went the other way and started, you know, trying to starve myself to death, thinking that maybe that would make it all better. And that doesn't work either. So I'm trying to strike a balance. It's a daily kind of deal.
Did you perform or write songs when you were a kid?
I started writing when I was 11, Terry.
That's a kid. That's pretty young.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been writing for over a quarter of a century.
Was it hard to imagine yourself on stage as a rock performer when you were very heavy?
No, it was as easy as picking up my brother's tennis racket and standing in front of the mirror, and it's almost like I would leave my body. And all of a sudden, I'd transform into like Elvis Presley or somebody like that.
We talked, you lived in Nashville and wrote songs there when you were very young. And I think you're living back in Nashville again, right?
I sure am. Yeah, I moved back 5 years ago.
What brought you back there?
Well, I've all of a sudden found myself a single parent, and I had a daughter a year old, and I was living in Los Angeles, and I just figured, you know, where can I go that I might could pull this off? And Nashville just came to mind as a place, you know, maybe, I thought to myself, maybe me and this little girl will have a chance of pulling through down there in Nashville. And it turned out to be a really good move for me. I met my wife there.
On a more professional level, is Nashville a good place for a songwriter now? I mean, does that matter to you that you're there when you're writing songs that other people might record?
Well, you know, I really like being there as a songwriter for the simple reason that it's a respected profession in that town.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, Hollywood is historically kind of tough on its writers. They never have treated them real well. And I'm speaking very generally, but I just like the way the songwriter is held in some esteem. I don't think it's beyond the, you know, the importance of the craft. But I do think that they assign it some kind of dignity as far as a creative professional skill goes, and I like that.
Do you sit at a desk and write your songs?
I don't. I've gotten a lot more flexible with that. I used to have to be in a certain room at a certain time with a certain guitar and pencils sharpened and notepads and all that kind of thing, legal pads. In the last 3 years or so with the kids, you know, we had a new baby 2 years ago. She's not a baby anymore, but now with three kids and the you know, working more as the career kicks up a little bit here, I've had to be more flexible in terms of where and when I can write. And that means, you know, in the back of a tour bus or, let's see, maybe if I go in, you know, this bedroom upstairs, you know, I can get away for 10 or 15 minutes before Georgia comes storming in and says, "What are you doing, Daddy?" So, you know, it's kind of catch as catch can, and it's really served to loosen me up, I think, in a good way as a writer.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking to us about your life and your music. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
John Hyatt's new album is called Stolen Moments. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.